So, the bait. This is one of those suttas where the teachings are very straightforward, and but given with a very memorable simile. So it's one of those things where once you've heard it or read the sutta, then you'll never forget it. It's one of those classic similes. The Buddha has this way of choosing his similes that have this almost like this archetypal power to them, where the simile he chooses is so appropriate and so memorable that it kind of becomes part of your consciousness, and you can't ever be without it again. And this is one of those very memorable little suttas. So this particular discourse has one parallel, which is Majjhima Agama 178, and the title in the Chinese translates as The Hunter. And whereas the Pali version takes place in Jeta's grove near Sarvati, then the Chinese version takes place at the squirrel's feeding place in Rajagaha, the Weluwana. So, which one is more likely to be correct? Different traditions, and especially the Pali, but also the others, tended to, when they forgot the name of where the sutta was took place, they just put down Sarvati. So, and where we see one saying it's at Sarvati and one saying it's somewhere else, that it's more likely that it actually took place at the other place rather than at Sarvati. It's only a probability. Okay, so, thus have I heard. At one occasion, the Blessed One was saying at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove in Attapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus, thus, bhikkhus. Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, a deer trapper does not lay down bait for a deer herd, intending thus. May the deer herd enjoy this bait that I've laid down, and so be long-lived and handsome and endure for a long time. A deer trapper lays down bait for a deer herd, thinking thus, the deer herd will eat food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that I have laid down. By doing so, they will become intoxicated. When they are intoxicated, they will fall into negligence. When they're negligent, I can do with them as I like on account of this bait. Right. So this is the first phrase of the, this is the deer trapper, is a nevapiko. So just as a grammatical point, we've mentioned this before, you see that the nivapang is the trap, yeah? And then the nevapiko, okay, is the trapper, and the nivapati is to trap, is the verb. So you actually have the trapper traps with the trap. Okay, so three words from the same, just different forms. And here's another word from the same form, nivuttang, this is a past participle, so trapped, when they are trapped with the trap, or in the trap. So, nevapiko, you notice all these ones have an I to start with. Okay, and yi. Okay, this one has an E to start with. And an E in Pali is a strengthened form or a lengthened form of the I. So, two I's equals E in Pali. Just as two U's equal O. And the reason why that's lengthened is because of this ending here. So when you put, this kind of ending is called secondary derivation ending. So this makes it into a personal ending, so same as we would use in English, trapper or trappist, probably closer related to trappist if you look at the form of it. And when you put that kind of ending on the on a word in Pali, then you often change the initial vowel. Okay, so I've talked about this a while ago, so it's not the difference between say child and children. Okay, so where you add an ending on and you change the initial vowel. So here the initial vowel has changed. Okay, now when these herd of deer, so the herd of deer is the migga, is a word which is usually used for deer and then often just for wild animals in general. Okay, migga jata, and jata here of course birth, and here having a meaning of herd. Okay, having eaten, paribhunjanta dighayuka, digha, long, as in long discourses, ayu is life, as in Ayurveda. Varnavanto. So here the word varna we met in the last few suttas. May they be varnavanto. May they be handsome. May they be good looking. Chirang. May they, for a long time, Digamadhanang, for a long period, Chirang, for a long period, Digamadhanang, again, the same meaning for a long period. So that's the first phrase of the trapa. Okay. So then the second phrase he says is, may these, having eaten the food, eaten, okay, Bhagavan Vinchita, okay, in the trap, Nigajata Anupakaja, okay, so Anupakaja means, going, is what Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as, going right in among them, okay, and this is a word that's found in the Vinaya as well, meaning going right up close to or something like that, Anupakaja. Muchita. Muchita is being intoxicated. Yeah. Negligent. Yeah. So this is what Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as intoxicant. Intoxicated. Muchita. Okay. Bhojanani bunjisanti. So here, having eaten the food. Okay. So, and again, notice these are the same. This is the verb and the noun from the same thing. So, eating the eats. Yeah, or feeding on the food, you have to say in English. Okay, and having eaten the food, madang apadisanti. So this is Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as, I've got two words here. Negligent. It sounds negligence. Bhikkhaja. Unwarily. Oh, sorry, no, I got that wrong. And by going right in among the bait. Okay, so this one's not what Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as intoxicated. This one is translated as unwarily. Okay, so unwarily, muchita. He ate the food, and then they became intoxicated, madang. It's more literally intoxicated, is in Sura Meraya, madja. Okay, is intoxicant. And so here is the fifth precept, Sura Meraya Madja Pamadatana. The Madja is the intoxicant, which is the Mada, which is of course whatever drives you mad. Yes, is the Mada. Okay. So always interesting when you look at these Indo-European roots, then they are always indicating of a word which was commonly used by the Aryan peoples before they split up into the Indian and European branches. So we're talking 2000, 3000 BC, one of the common words which is stuck in the tradition, and that's mad, is one of them. So obviously had some meaning for them at the time. Matta samana pamadang. So here pamadang is an intensified form of madang, okay, and meaning negligent, yeah.
In the precept,
you know,
it says no drinking.
Yep.
None of those words
feature,
is it?
Yeah, it has a word mada, but it's in a different form. It's in the form madja. Madja pamada tana, yeah, madja pamada, yeah. Yeah? So the same sequence, mada and then pamada. But if that's just a formation of an abstract, if you add a YA on the end, then that becomes madja. Okay. And yata kama karaniya. Yata, just as karma wishes karaniya, does. Okay, does with him just as he wishes. Bhavi santi. Okay. So this is the trapper. Now the deer of the first herd ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper had laid down. By doing so, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, the deer trapper did with them as he liked on account of that bait. That is how the deer of the first herd failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Right, so that's the first herd. Does exactly what the deer trapper wants them to do. Right, now, the deer of the second herd, they reckoned thus. So here, reckon, sama chintesum, they reckon thus. The deer that first heard, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food, shunning that fearful enjoyment. Okay, bhaya bhoga, fearful enjoyment. Okay, why don't we sabso completely shun that shun pati vira me yama? Okay, viramani. So this is again similar to the word that's found in the precepts where it says viramani, and this is actually the same word in here, virame. Okay, but you don't. It's kind of again it's disguised, but this is the same root. To dispel or have nothing to do with, okay? That bhaya bhoga, that fearful food, yeah? Bhaya bhoga. Let us go out into the forest wilds and live there, okay? Let us go out into the aranya yatanani. So, they sound like they're doing the right thing, don't they? Okay, they sound like this herd of deer has got it together, yeah? They are not your average kind of deer. They're getting together, they're thinking, hang on, watch out for this trapper. Let's go out in the deep forest and then we'll be right. So, that's what they did. But, in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. With that, they lost their strength and energy. When they lost their strength and energy, they returned to that same bait that the deer trapper had laid down. They ate food unwarily by going right in amongst it. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, the deer trapper did with them as he liked on account of that bait. And that is how the deer of the second herd also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Okay, so notice the word he's using for power and control down here. It's possibly not idhanu bhava. Idha is idhi, we use for psychic powers, but also used in like a worldly sense, meaning power or success. And anubhava, we have in some of the chants we do, buddhanu bhavena, dhammanu bhavena, sanghanu bhavena. And so this is the anubhava. Sometimes this is obviously used in a worldly context, but often in a religious context, you translate it as the glory or the splendor. Okay? Right. So, the third deer herd reckoned thus. The deer that first herd failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control, as did the deer of the second herd. Suppose we make our dwelling place within range of the deer trappers bait. So when they're saying that, suppose the idiom that they're using here is yanuna. Okay, what if we were to? Okay, so it's not suppose, but it's like, what if we were to do that? Yanuna mayang. Okay, again, this is a very common idiom. It's always used with that kind of reflective sense. Yanuna, yanuna hang. What if I were to? Or yanuna mayang. What if we were to? Okay. We make our dwelling place within range of the deer trapper's bait. Then, having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid down. By doing so, we shall not fall into negligence. When we're not negligent, the deer trapper shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait. And that's what they did. Okay?
You keep speaking about intoxicated. We will not get intoxicated if we don't eat the bait. What sort of bait could it possibly be that
might be intoxicated?
Or is it in fact?
Yeah, it's not. No, it just means negligent. It's actually probably an overly literal translation here, and also a bit misleading because it goes from intoxicated to then to negligent. But negligent is a much weaker word than intoxicated in English, whereas in Pali it's actually the other way around. It's mada, pamada is a stronger word. Yeah. So I don't know what you'd use. Yeah. No, it doesn't literally mean they're staggering around, infatuated or confused or. But I don't know if you say there was a very very funny movie that was made of the animals in Africa that were eating the fermented fruit. Have you ever seen that? That's quite a well known one. There's this particular kind of tree that made this fermented fruit, and then all the giraffes and stuff went over. They're all eating this thing, and then just literally just staggering around, drunk off their vine. That's going to be funny. So perhaps, yeah, not necessarily the best rendering there. Okay. So, then the deer trapper and his following are considered thus. Okay, so this is the first time we've heard about the following, the parisa of the deer trapper. They considered thus, so they're having to up the ante, they're having to upgrade their thing. These deer of the third herd are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. Okay. Satu Sandamane, Ketubina is cunning and crafty. Idhimanta. Okay. Idhi, again, psychic powers. Idhimanta is possessed of psychic powers. So like wizards who are possessed of psychic powers. They also use the word Vijadhara, which is more literally wizard. Atiya Migijata. Parajana. Parajana. This must be the word he's translated as sorcerers. I'm not familiar with that word, Parajana. Yeah. Here it just says foreign. Para means other. And jana means person. So like a foreigner. Maybe like some kind of alien. Maybe an alien, maybe it's what I'm saying. Maybe they're as powerful as wizards and aliens. Maybe this is the first ever reference to aliens. This is something that should be investigated by the Dhamma experts. Okay. Imancha nama nivapa nivutam paribunjanti. Okay. So, they eat the bait laid down without our knowing how they come and go. Suppose. So again, now these guys are thinking. Yanunamayam. Suppose. We have the bait that is laid down, completely surrounded all around over a wide area with wicker hurdles. Okay? Then perhaps we might see the third deer high herd's dwelling place where they go to hide. Okay? They do so, and they saw the third deer's dwelling place where they went to hide. And that is how the deer of the third herd also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. So what's going on here? What does the trap involve here? Eva, be careful. Sorry, just assuming the worst. No. The question is, okay, we have the bait that's laid down. What's actually going on? I want to visualize. What's actually happening here when he's laying the bait down? He's laying down the bait, right? Completely surrounded all over a wide area with wicker hurdles. And then perhaps we might see their dwelling place, where they're going to hide. How is surrounding the bait with wicker hurdles going to enable them to see where the dwelling place is? Wicker hurdles, wicker obstacles.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. The hurdles down, and then you'll see the orientation.
Yeah.
Maybe down and walk through to
them. Okay.
You would see north-south people
like the word. Eva prefers that they were looking at it. Okay, but that's good. Mahatihi danda vakarahi. Danda. Here we have the danda. Danda vakarahi. Okay. Vagurahi, and you'll see we have these two quite different readings here. This is a Thai reading. Vagurahi, Vakarahi. So this is the word is translated as the hurdles, but I think Vakara, again, not a particularly common word. Danda Vakarahi, here my dictionary says it means a stem, stick, cudgel, walking stick, or timber, or a fine or punishment. But I think they're just translating dunder there. Yeah. Anyway, so some kind of stick thing. But I think you're quite right that they'll knock them down, and then they'll see where they're coming from, and then they'll get them right. Okay, that's good. Now, the steer of a fourth herd. Reckon thus, the chatutta, the fourth Nigadatta, even Samachintesyan. Now, all those other guys were bloody hopeless, and they all got trapped. Okay? Now, suppose Yanuna, again, supposing that we make our dwelling place where the deer trapper and his following cannot go. Then, having done so, we will eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid down. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we're not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we're not negligent, the deer trapper shall not do with us as he likes on account of his bait. And they did so. Okay. Now, then, the deer trapper and his following consider thus, etadahosi, the following occurred to the deer trapper and his following. Deer of this fourth herd are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. They eat the bait laid down without unknowing how they come and go. Suppose we have the bait that is laid down completely surrounded all over on a wide area with wicker hurdles, then perhaps we might see the fourth deer herd's dwelling place where they go to hide. They did so, but they did not see the fourth deer herd's dwelling place where they went to hide. And the deer hunter and his following considered thus, if we scare the fourth deer herd, being scared they will alert others, and so the deer herds will all desert this bait that we've laid down. Suppose we treat the fourth deer herd with indifference. They did so. And that was how the deer of the fourth deer herd got free from the deer trapper's power and control. Okay? So now they're thinking better off just to leave them. And so, now for the final consideration of the hunters. Sache komayang, if Sache komayang tatute migijate gate sama, if we hassle or do violent towards them, then they will be te gatita anye, and then they alert others. Te gatita anye gatita santi. Okay, they will alert others, and then they, when they're alerted, they'll alert others. So then all of the deer herds will be freed from this trap. Sounds a bit like the Bodhisattva, doesn't it? So here is the word to have equanimity towards them. And it's their indifference, or equanimity, aju bekheyama. And the root here is bekha, to look. Pekka? Is that of an English cognate? Pekka. Pekka is to look. Pekka. Not about Pekka. What am I talking about? It's to look is Ika. To look is Ika. And Upa, Ika. And then the Aj is a Adhi at the beginning, just intensifying. So to look over something, Upeka has a meaning here, to over looking, watching over something. In the context here, it obviously means indifference, and they're kind of not just ignoring them basically. But that's not what it normally means. Then, because I have given this simile, again, the upama, that we've had the whole chapter on upamas, kata, I have made, kata, the upama, athasa, for vinyapanaya, for the making known. Okay, so here is vinyapanaya, this is from vinyana, okay, and notice that it has this pa in here, so, and it's like, it's actually an apa, and this is indicating a causative form, okay. So this is one of the kinds of forms that you have in Pali, causative form. So you have a particular word, and the causative form means to make or to cause whatever the meaning of that word is. So here, vinyapanaya, vinyana means to be known. So to make it known, the causative form of vinyana is to make it known. All right. So to make known the meaning of the simile. Okay. And here is the meaning, the atta. Right. Bait is a term for the five cords of sensual pleasure. panchanetan kama gunanang adhivachanang. And I think I've mentioned this before, but the translation of cords of sensual pleasure is kama guna. Sensual pleasure kama guna usually means the qualities or kinds of sensual pleasure. The translation of it as a cord is, as far as I know, only found within the Pali tradition. It seems to be particular, like a kind of one of these kind of metaphorical etymologies, where, because of course you get attached to it, so it says it's like a cord, but it's actually, I don't think it's literally what it means, and it's not described in that way in the northern traditions, as far as I know. Okay, the deer hunter is a term for Mara, the evil one. Okay. There's an interesting, we have here the book, a very wonderful book, The History of God. I don't know if anyone's read it, but should have a read of it, Karen Armstrong's classic. But there's another one which is also around, which is called The History of the Devil, which is also a very interesting read. And one of the findings or the themes of that particular book, The History of the Devil, was that if you look in almost all cultures, their image of the devil is... You don't have this image of this kind of implacable, total evil, which we associate with Satan from the Christian tradition. This is like a particular kind of projection of Western Christian mentality. And almost all other cultures, the evil one has more kind of redeeming features and is a bit more of a balanced character. And often is more like the trickster character. If you know, in ancient mythology, you have this classic trickster archetype. Who sort of represents like Hermes, or a classic one is like Loki in the northern mythology, many of them, but that's like the monkey, yeah, he's like the trickster and the naughty one, and for example, Karen Armstrong points out the example of when the Iranians called America the Great Satan. And for us, it was like an image where they were saying that America is this kind of, you know, implacable, total evil. Whereas she said that from the Islamic point of view, Satan was, again, more of this kind of trickster character who's more kind of trivial and worldly and not concerned with spiritual things. So it's more like America is the great trivializer rather than the great paragon of evil. And of course, you find exactly the same thing within the Buddhist tradition, that Mara, although he's supposed to be the Satan, but he's not actually a particularly good Satan. He doesn't come out kind of breathing fire and with horns and things like that. He's more of a figure of fun than anything else. And and even the word papa, which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as evil, which it's difficult to get away from that translation, but for example, we saw a couple of weeks ago in the Kakatupama Sutta where the naughty maid was described as Papi Dasi. Okay, so you'd never say the evil maid because she got up a bit late, yeah, to test the thing. You wouldn't say evil, you say, well, kind of naughty or something like that. And so it's the same word, Papi. And also used just for any unwholesome thought, like Papakanga Kusalang Dhammang. So any kind of unwholesome thought or mental state is called Papakang. Again, you wouldn't say evil in English just because you had a nasty thought or a sensual thought or something like that. You wouldn't describe it as evil. You might describe it as unskillful or whatever. The deer trapper's following is a term for the following of Mara. The herd of deer is a term for the samanas and the brahmanas. Okay, so samana brahmana, the samana, translated as recluse or ascetic. Karman, yeah, the translation of the Karman is taking the root as being sama, which means even, okay, as in samatha. In fact, that's not the actual root. The actual root is shram, which is to weary oneself. Okay, so this is why the translation ascetic is perhaps the best. Brahmana, of course, being one of the Brahmin castes. Now, Indian tradition, in the earliest strata of India's religious thought, say in the Rig Veda, the Brahma has a meaning something like the force. Okay, as in Star Wars, right? This is the oldest meaning of Brahma which we can get. It's something like the force, yeah? Or you'd say maybe something like chi or something like that. It's some kind of nebulous spiritual energy, but that's that which empowers, okay? So it's a sense of spiritual power. But very vaguely thought of and not really well defined. And then later on, of course, you know, then you become the Mara as a god. Mara becomes the embodiment of that spiritual power. And Brahmanas are the ones who channel and make use of that kind of spiritual power. And that spiritual power originally would have been the power of growth. Very largely is the power of growth. So it's the power that makes the crops come up from the soil, yeah? It's the power of fertility, the power of the energy of life, and so on. And so by the time of the Buddha, then this had become, the term had become fossilized to a caste meaning. Now the caste, the Brahmin caste, is very controversial about where they actually came from. But one conventional theory, and I just mentioned this to give you a bit of background, is that when the Aryans came into India, say 1500 BC or so, around about that time, in a gradual process, they had their kind of religious shaman kind of figures who were the seers of the Vedas and who were the priests and so on in their rituals. And that caste became known as the Brahmin caste. The indigenous Indian people, again according to this particular theory, which has some good points and some bad points, but according to this particular theory, the local or the indigenous Indian peoples also had their own kind of shaman priest kind of figures, and they were suppressed for a while by the Aryans, but then later on made a resurgence, and when they made their resurgence they became the summoners. Okay, not saying it's necessarily the same people, but it's just like different kind of strands. Another way of thinking about it, if you compare with English, well, with European history, It's not by any means the same, but comparable to the idea of, say, the Brahmins would be like the Catholics, and the Samanas would be like the Gnostic traditions, who in some ways were earlier than the Catholics, were suppressed, but then later sort of bubbled up through the alchemists and mystics and so on, who were sort of operating kind of on the outside of the Orthodox tradition, but who were partly influenced by the Orthodox tradition, but also partly in touch with the kind of the pre-Orthodox nature religions and mystic religions and so on, mystery religions. So that's just to give you a general idea of what we're talking about here with the Samanas and Brahmins. But specifically with the Samanas, that they were movements which started sometime before the Buddha, maybe 200-300 years before the Buddha. The Jains are probably the earliest Shramana movement. And the Buddha's own dispensation in many ways was very typical of all the Shramana or Samana movements at that time, okay? So they all rejected the caste system, they all rejected the Vedic sacrifices, they all rejected the authority of the Vedas, and so on and so forth. So it was a very vibrant religious milieu. And I think I mentioned a little while ago in Patanjali's grammar, he mentions this is a kind of Dwanda compound, Samanas and Brahmins, and it's an example of the kind of Samana Dwanda compound comprised of two elements, both of which are perpetually at war with each other. Okay? So this is actually in the classical Sanskrit grammar. It says if this is an example where you can put compound two elements which are perpetually at war with each other, the Samanas and the Brahmanas. Okay? So it's used in the suttas as a generic term for all kinds of religious practitioners. Okay, so when we see some of the Brahmana encompasses all kinds of religious practitioners, whether Buddhist or non-Buddhist and so on. Okay. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the first recluses and Brahmins of the first kind ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait and the material things of the world that Mara had laid down. Okay, lokamisani. Okay, amisa, the material things of the world. By so doing, they become intoxicated when they're intoxicated. They fell into negligence when they were negligent. Mara did with them as he liked on account of that bait and those material things of the world. This is how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the first herd. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the second kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food and those material things of the world, shunning that fearful enjoyment, let us go out into the forest wilds and live there. And they did so. There they were eaters of greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or the discarded scum of boiled rice or sesame flour or grass or cow dung. They lived on forest roots and fruits. They fed on fallen fruits. Okay. So here's all the list of foods, of course, being that one of the practices that the Buddha himself did before his enlightenment, living on all of these things. Gomaya Bhakapi, eaters of cow dung. This is what Ajahn Brahm and I used as one of our code words when we were doing negotiations with the politicians and the lawyers. Whenever they said some gomayang, we'd just sort of look at each other and say gomayang, and they didn't know what we were talking about. That actually means cow shit. So I mean, the first group is pretty straightforward. You know, they're just kind of lost it, and they just like not even have a hope. But the second one, they're obviously pretty committed. You know, they've really, you know, they've gone out. They're living in the middle of the jungle, and they're eating all this stuff. I mean, it's not easy to do. Now, in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. Okay. Adimattakasimana. Kasi is the emaciation. Yeah. Adi is an intensifier. Matta is a degree, so a great degree of kasimana. Okay. And they lost their strength in it. They lost their strength and energy. Balavirye. When they lost their strength and energy, they lost their deliverance of mind. Parihine ceto vimutti parihai. When they lost their deliverance of mind, they returned to that same bait that Mara had laid down and those material things of the world. They ate food unwarily by going right in amongst it. By so doing, they became intoxicated, and Mara did with them as he liked. So this raises just a couple of questions, like what's this deliverance of mind that's been talking about, Ceto Vimutti? It's a bit curious, because the previous paragraph didn't, Ceto Vimutti normally means practice of jhanas, yeah? At least, if not higher attainments. And here, there was no talk, I mean, obviously they were living out in their own forest and stuff, but it didn't actually talk about them doing meditation, so it's somewhat curious. Venerable Analia makes the following comment. I haven't been referring to Venerable Analia's comparative study simply because there's very little difference between the two. But in this point, the Chinese version says not only that they lost their deliverance of mind, but also their deliverance by wisdom, the Panya Vimutti. And Analia comments, the last must be a textual corruption, since unlike the deliverance of the mind, which covers deeper stages of concentration that can indeed be lost again, the deliverance through wisdom stands for awakening something that cannot be lost again. Okay, so the Chinese adds here the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom, probably just as a part of an automatic, it's kind of like a habit, the kind of a lazy reciter probably lost their mindfulness as they were reciting it, and they kind of jeto vimutti, panya vimutti, it's one of these standard phrases which you've recited dozens of times before, and so it just kind of slips in there. But, Analo goes on, even to speak of these recluses and Brahmins losing their deliverance of mind as found in both versions is a little odd in the present context. Odd since it stands in contrast to the fourth group of recluses and Brahmins who are able to go beyond the range of Mara's power by gaining the jhanas. Hence, one may wonder what the difference could be between gaining deliverance of the mind and gaining the jhanas. According to the commentarial explanation, deliverance of the mind in the present refers to these recluses and Brahmins giving up their resolution to live in the forest. Okay? Although this explanation does help to mark a difference between the second and the fourth group of recluses and Brahmins, it constitutes an interpretation of the expression deliverance of the mind, which is different from the implications of this term in its canonical usage. Okay, so there we have the problem. Venerable Nalu doesn't really suggest any solutions, and nor do I. It just seems like a slightly unusual usage there. Whether the commentary is right and it really means that they lost their simply their resolution to live in the forest, that certainly fits the context, but it doesn't really fit the usage of Teto Vimuti in other places. But then maybe it's just an unusual usage as well. Okay. So just to go back, just go on. I think the difference is that when the Buddha did that, he had an actual positive idea of why he was doing it. Yeah. He said, no, this is what I've got to do this path, because that's when he thought, oh, maybe I should practice jhanas instead. And then he thought, oh, well, to do that, I need to eat. Okay, so that's when he had a purpose for doing it. Whereas these guys just can't handle it anymore. Yeah? And so they don't have any alternative thing. They had their practice, which they've now lost. So they basically failed in their original practice.
So just talking about those ascetics who just go out there and eat one grain of rice a day, and then they get to the point they either die, and they go back to their five cores, so to speak.
Yeah. This is kind of satirized in the suttas quite a few times, where you know the people go out and they keep these things and they get really skinny and stuff like that. And then the Buddha says, but can they eat like that forever? He says, no, after a while they give up their practice and they come back and live in the house again and eat lots of good food and get fat again.
The Brahmins also
the Buddha said, this is how there comes to be the increase and the reduction of the body.
The Brahmin practice at that time was it not to go for 15 or 20 years?
Uh-huh.
Stay celibate and do all these ascetic practices, and then they go back to being married and having kids and
yeah, possibly. Although that particular Brahman scheme of having the different periods of life, which isn't really current yet in the Buddha's time, and in part it was probably. That part of the aspect of it was probably like in reaction to the Shramana traditions, like Buddhism, where they actually partially adopted it within their own tradition. So there may have been some similar things in Brahmanism at the time, but it wasn't like a really settled thing. In fact, it probably never was, actually. It's probably more of just a theoretical scheme. But yeah, I mean, so this is the idea is, so to go off, and to really think, see, this is the idea is that you really, it's a very kind of absolutist position, and you're really thinking, I'm going to have nothing to do with anybody, yeah? And you go there and you realize you just can't do it, yeah? And, I mean, I guess there are some people probably who can, you know, and there are some, you know, who just go and just see it or whatever, but for the vast majority of people, you just can't do it, yeah. And then the time comes when you need to come back and so on. And in its own different way, it's similar to the experience that many people have when they go sometimes to ordain, and in some of these intensive meditation monasteries where they just ordain, and then the next day it's just meditate, you know. And so you just meditate, and then at the end of the time. Something happens. Your visa runs out, or you get sick, or you just lose your energy, or whatever. And you've got to go and do something, and you don't know how to. And you don't know how am I going to do this? How am I going to travel? How am I going to go to another country? How am I going to find the medical support that I need?
Not sustainable,
yeah. So it's an interesting one. But I think, you know, it would have definitely... throwing this one out there, you know, because it sounds like it's sounds good, you know. Sounds, you read it, sound like they're going out into the forest and stuff. Sounds good. Okay. Now, the third group of recluses and Brahmins. Now, suppose that we make our dwelling place within range of that bait that Mara has laid down in those material things of the world. Then having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that Mara has laid down and the material things of the world. Okay? So they're going to be very careful. And amuchita, natmada. Okay, so they're not going to be negligent and intoxicated. And they did so. Okay. But apichako, okay, so apichako, but evang dietika ahesung, they had such of views, they were people with of such views. Sasato loko itipi, the world is eternal. Sasato loko itipi, the world is not eternal. Antawa loko itipi, antawa, anta is the end, okay, so it's corresponds to the word end in English, antava. The word world is ended or finite. The world is anantava, is infinite. Loko. Tang jivang tang sarirang itipi. So remember I mentioned this when talking in the Lagadupama Sutta, this particular idiom. And in that case it was so loko, so atta. And here it's exactly parallel, tang jivang tang sarirang. So the jiva, the life force or the soul, is identical with the body. Okay? So this is what this one means. Tang jivang tang sarirang. And the repetition of tang and tang is an emphatic identity. Tang jivang tang sarirang. Okay? So if you had yang jivang tang sarirang, it would be, what is the soul that is the body? Or the soul is the body. Okay? In English, you'd say the soul is the body. And this is more emphatic. The soul is identical with the body. Anyang jivang, anyang sarirang is the opposite. One thing is the soul, another thing is the body. Okay? And that, of course, was this is the view, the term jiva was current in the Jains. So the Brahmins tended to use the word atta, and the Jains tended to use the word jiva. Hoti tathagato paramarana itipi. The tathagata exists after death. Na hoti tathagato paramarana. The tathagata does not exist after death. Hoti chana hoti cha hoti. Hoti chana hoti. Hoti cha na cha. Hoti cha na cha hoti. Right. Hoti cha na cha hoti. The tathagata exists and does not exist after death. And the neva hoti na na hoti. It neither exists nor not exists as a tathagata after death. Okay, so these are the very famous series of 10 speculative views which are counted many times in the suttas. And as you see here, that these are views which are attributed to non-Buddhist ascetics. And of course, these are the famous questions which the Buddha refused to answer in some occasions, and partly because they're useless speculation and would traps one into metaphysical presuppositions which the Buddha didn't want to get involved in. And of course, you know, we can see that these kinds of questions, the Buddha said basically you can keep on trying to answer these and you'll never find an answer. And indeed, that is in fact the case, isn't it? That people are still trying to work out, is the world eternal or is it not eternal? Is it finite or is it infinite? And is the soul the same as the body? And so on and so forth. And these are still being debated by philosophers and scientists today. And so interesting that that's still going on and will probably never be finished, those debates. And just a note on the word tathagata here. Of course, normally means the Buddha. Sometimes it's used in the meaning of any enlightened being. Okay, so tathagata here, it seems to have that meaning, any enlightened being. Hoti tathagata paramarana. Okay? Therefore, because they had all those different kinds of views, then they were not freed from the power of Mara. Okay, so this is like the ones who kept on tripping over the hurdles. Yeah. Does that work?
Not that part,
no. Giving themselves away. Yeah, but he found all of them. For some reason, they had their views gave them away. But why is it like hurdles that are tripped over? Maybe their views gave them away because they were arguing about them, and then Mara heard them and said, "What's that racket over there?" Yeah, interesting. Okay, then the fourth one. Right. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the fourth kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, and so on and so forth, so forth. Suppose we make our dwelling place where Mara and his following cannot go. Then, having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that Mara has laid down and the material things of the world. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated, and then Mara will not do with us as he likes. That is how those recluses and Brahmins of the fourth kind got free from Mara's power and control. Okay, so they're going to go where, make their dwelling place where Mara can't go, and then they're going to go in warily and eating the food. So of course this, for recluses and religious people in the Buddha's time, then of course in part that was a very literal injunction on going for alms round. So of course, you know, when you go for alms round, that's the time when you're exposed to all the stuff of the world. You come out of the forest and there's all the people and all the things going on and all the distractions and everything, and of course literally the food is the kind of the major sensual hit which renunciates get during the day. So, you know, it's quite, in that sense it's quite literal, but also used obviously in a more general sense. Warily go amongst the things of the world, okay, but then also have a place and have a refuge where you can go where those things can't follow you.
That particular section is the introduction to the Arahant. The only place Mara can't go is to the Arahant. Mara has access everywhere else. You could say Jhana, but that's temporary.
Well, let's see what the Sutta says. Right, where are we? Yata Agati, where Mara does not go. Where? Is it that Mara and Mara's assembly do not go? Idha bhikkhave bhikkhu viviceva kamehi vivita kusalehi dhammehi savitakam savitaram vivekadang piti sukham patamang jhanam upasampadavitare. Ayang vuchati bhikkhave bhikkhu andhamakasi Mara. This is called a monk who has blinded Mara. Okay? Apadang avadhitva mara chakkhum adasanang gato papi mato andha. Andhamakasi. Andha is blind. Akasi means made. So has made blind. Has made Mara blind. Okay. To become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. Okay. No, Papimato is the evil one.
So all us schmucks who cannot do jhana are a wide open field. Well, something ought to be done about it.
Something ought to be done about it. Let's build a forest monastery. Right. Yes. And then second jhana, third jhana, and so on. So, Viharati is dwelling, Upasampadja is having entered. Yeah. This is the same word as Upasampada.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just means Upasampada is just a noun form. You'd say entering, and this is the past sense, so having entered. But usually just say enters and dwells, but it's actually having entered, one dwells. Okay. So I've been over the terminology and the jhana formulas a few times. So it's not a bad thing to repeat these, but I'm not sure, maybe leave it for a while. Does anyone want me to go over that once more now, or we've been over this enough already? Maybe leave it for a few weeks or something, and then we'll get another one and we can do it again. Yeah. And then from there to the four formless jhanas, the Chinese version, Sarvastivadin version, differs in including the four Brahma Viharas as well. And this is something which is quite common in the Madhyama Agama, that they, where the Pali has just the four form attainments and four formless, the Chinese also has the Brahma Viharas. And some have suggested that this is an indication of the more emphasis on metta and compassion in those traditions, as opposed to the Theravada tradition.
Is it just in the case of this particular?
No, quite a few suttas, yeah. It's quite standard in those, you know, like that list that we have of the four jhanas and four formless, they'll always put the four Brahma Viharas in there as well. So whether it's actually meaningful or whether it's just a product of later systematization, I'm not sure.
Would there possibly be a context in terms of this particular sutta's relation to protecting the mind and protecting yourself? Would the Brahma Vihara be then injected in as a part of a protective package?
Yeah, but I mean, yes, that's true that they are, but I think it's more just that's the standard way it's presented in this in the Madhyama Agama. Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's very, very standard. In terms of the exact, because, you know, usually as the suttas, they just sort of present one after the other. How it's actually explained, I don't know. You'd have to look, probably something like a Sangha or something like that would probably give an explanation for what the exact relationship is between how it was interpreted. Yeah. Okay, so then the formless attainment. So sometimes it's convenient we use the word jhana, the formless jhanas, but it's interesting to note that the word jhana is not usually used. There's one or two possible exceptions, but generally speaking, the word jhana is not used of the formless attainments. They're called samapatti or something else. And again, I've been over this, but just run over it again quickly. And again, because sabbas are completely transcending due to the, okay, here is the ablative case, samatikkama, complete transcending of perceptions of form. So the rupa here is the samadhi nimitta, the vision or the light that's perceived in the form jhanas. Okay, it's the rupa sanya. And the patigraha sanya, the hitting or impingement, perceptions of impingement, is the sense of, with the form, is still part of the rupakaya in the Mahanidana Sutta, it talks about this as being associated with the padiga sampasa, or padiga contact. The idea is that when we have a samadhi nimitta, one of the words for a nimitta is reflection. Okay, so a nimitta is like a reflection built up out of perception. Okay, so this is the word sanya is used here, built up out of perception from what we have seen and known in the world. Okay. And so even though it's not itself a sense object, it's something that's just perceived in the mind, but it's a reflection of those things which we've known in the world, okay? So things like lights or colors and things like that. And so because of that, it still has some of those qualities and some of those limitations of those things. So this is why it has that idea of form, or the patigo is still like a limitation on that perception, okay? And that's what you're transcending when you go into this, the formless attainments. Okay, so there's no padigha, so there's no restriction on the perception. I mean, this, when you say restriction, I mean it's all relative. Yeah, I mean someone who's in the fourth jhana is not there sitting there thinking, oh, my consciousness is so restricted and constrained. It's all relevant, but it's only when you've transcended it that you know what that limitation was. So this is what this is referring to, and the nānatta saññānaṁ amanasikāra is the perceptions of diversity, so not paying attention to perceptions of diversity. Ananto ākāso ākāsañca yatanaṁ upasampajjo viharati. So space is infinite. Okay. So in a sense, this is still derived from a material thing. Okay. So the idea of space is still derived from matter, isn't it? Yeah. If it wasn't for matter, we wouldn't have space. Yeah. And so there's still this kind of faint echo in there of the material world. Yeah. Even though it's just infinite space, and there's no limits or anything on the mind, but there's still this faint reflection of the material world in that attainment.
When you're in that infinite space, does the person who is in that jhana, are they part of the infinite space, or can they say look down and they see they're there?
Well, they can't.
No, they couldn't look down or see their leg.
So they're all part of the space.
Yeah, they're just totally immersed in it. Yeah.
And so the base of nothingness is the same?
Even more so.
I want to attain it.
Well, that's good. You keep on going. Yeah. So
infinite consciousness is a bit of a puzzle, though.
Yeah. Punichaparang.
Do you think that the states can be attained without going through the four mukhas?
No. No. It's a bit of a controversial question, and sometimes it's raised up because in the story of the Buddha's practice before he was enlightenment. Yeah. And he went and he just got into these formless attainments and doesn't mention the four jhanas, and people therefore say that you can get into formless attainments without doing the four jhanas. But that's entirely unwarranted from the text. All the text says was that was the highest attainment that he reached. It tells us nothing about what he did before that. Or rather, it actually does tell us what he did before that. And what it says that he did was he got these faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And it actually mentions those things, and that's the five spiritual faculties. And the spiritual faculty of samadhi is always defined as the four jhanas. So it actually tells us, more or less, it doesn't explicitly mention the four jhanas, but it's pretty clear that that's what he'd done beforehand, and then as the outcome, the highest reach of that, this is what he reached.
Why did he say that what I did with Alara Palama and so on, that didn't lead to success, and now I go and practice those jhanas?
Yeah. Yeah.
The way to enlighten
them. Yeah.
Isn't it strange?
Well, that's I believe that's going to be the very next sutta. So we'll leave that as a mystery, okay? So then we'll have to ponder that question: why is it that the Buddha rejected his practice under the previous ascetics and then yet went on to seemingly embrace the same practice? A tension which is not dissimilar to the tension that we've discerned within this same sutta itself, because we've already talked about the samanas and brahmanas who had the chaitta vimutti and then going on to jhana. So it's not dissimilar. Maybe not the same, but not dissimilar. Anyway, having overcome infinite space, right, this infinite space business, boring, right? You know, it's like, just give me a break, man. Do I just have to sit here for another week in this thing? Get rid of this infinite space, anantang vinyananti. That's how you have to do it. That's actually the process that it describes in the Visuddhimagga to overcome each particular meditation attainment, right? If you develop them methodically, when you get to one particular attainment, you have to keep on doing that again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And when you've really mastered that and you're really solid with it, then you reflect on the disadvantages and limitations of it, okay? And then that lets you let go of that and then go on to the next one. But you have to make sure you really master it beforehand. If you don't master it beforehand, you start reflecting on the limitations and you won't be able to get back there. It's like there's this mirror and there's this image, right? Right? You're seeing this reflection, this vision in this mirror, okay? This is like Rupa Jhanas, yeah? And then you've taken away the mirror, yeah? And there's just the image is left. Yeah, and so that's like infinite space. Yeah. Or another way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking, another way of thinking about it maybe better is that you know, when you normal consciousness is like looking into the mirror, and then you take away the mirror and you just have the image of the mirror, and that's like the form jhanas, yeah. And then you take away the image, and you just look at the space where the image used to be, and then that's the base of infinite space, yeah, yeah. So you're just looking at the space where the image used to be, and then you take away that space. Yeah, and you just look at what the consciousness is that is knowing that space. Yeah? What is it that's just aware of that space? So then you're turning around, this is the base of infinite consciousness.
What is knowing that space?
What is knowing the space, yeah. And then, completely, and then you think, boring, infinite consciousness, here I go, mind one with the universe again. What am I going to do now? Where am I going to get some fun? I know. I'm going to completely renounce the base of infinite consciousness. Nati kinchi. Okay? Then even the knowing mind, one doesn't perceive the knowing mind anymore. Nati kinchi. Okay? Nothing.
Do you do this? Do you sit there saying, oh, this is rubbish?
Nati kinchi, okay? Akinchanya yatananga sampadriviharati. Right, okay? Nothing. So that's pretty cool, right? I think, whoa. It is, yeah, it's more fun, yeah. This is there's certain kinds of surfers who specialize in this attainment. And actually, okay, then you're thinking this nothingness business. I'm still perceiving this nothingness. And maybe it'd be better if there wasn't perception, but then maybe there's not no perception either. Neva sanya na sanya yatanang. So that the perception of infinite space of nothingness remains, but it becomes so subtle that it's this never-not construction in Pali usually means some kind of subtle state or some kind of in-between or indefinable state. So when you say it's neither perception nor non-perception, it's defined as saying it doesn't, in the commentary definition says it doesn't exercise the decisive function of perception, and yet there's not a complete absence of perception. So it's never-sanya-na-sanya. So of course these things becoming progressively harder to imagine and more abstract as they go along until, you know, they're finally unthinkable. So this is what they sometimes call the eight jhanas, or the eight attainments. And just to come back to your question earlier, Max, I didn't finish the second part of that. Apart from that particular passage with the Larika Lama and so on, there's also many, many passages where it talks about these eight attainments. Now, when it's presented here, they're just presented one after the other. But notice that it says at the beginning, it says punacha parang, okay? Where it says, you know, and then, you know, so it has a continuing, yeah? So this punacha parang means, and again, yeah? So it's continuing on for the previous one. So it certainly is presented in a way that makes it seem as if it's a continuation. But there are also other contexts where it makes it more explicit, and it calls these like the successive cessations, anupubha nirodha. So in each one, something else is being dropped off. Yeah? And so when you understand the internal structure of it, you realize that these are actual stages where something more is continually being dropped off. Yeah? And so there is actually an internal logic to them. Yeah. Yeah, I haven't really studied it much. There is quite an interesting book called Nibbana, Nihilism and Satori, which was done by Dr. Douglas Burns, who was a student of Ajahn Chah, who disappeared mysteriously into the forest. And, he was the one that Ajahn Titanyano found. He found him in the spirit realm. This fellow Douglas Burns was a kind of a bit of a character, and a bit of a, kind of the wild days in Thailand in the early 70s, and he went to stay with Ajahn Chah and so on, and apparently Ajahn Chah quite respected his intelligence and so on, and one of the things he did was wrote this book, Nibbana, Nihilism and Satori, where he compares the accounts of Nibbana with descriptions of nihilism and also with the Satori experiences. Is Satori the same as Kensho? I'm not sure. I don't know. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think Kensho is, Satori is bigger and
Kensho is. Okay. And anyway, he disappeared in the south of Thailand and nobody knew where he was. And they sent helicopters after him and all of these kinds of things searching through the jungle and they never found him. Many years later, Ajahn Titignano was in Bangkok and visited this very eccentric psychic power monk in Bangkok. And one of the things he asked him was, where's Stella Douglas Burns gone? And he said, what did he look like or something, and describe. And so his description, he was just kind of sitting there chewing betel nut. And he sort of, he's not in heaven anywhere. I can't see him. Let me go look downstairs. He says, he's just going to check. I can't see him anywhere. You know, you sure you've got the description right or whatever? And then he described him some more, and he kept looking for him, and then he found him, and he hadn't taken rebirth, and his consciousness was still like almost like a hungry ghost or in between state in the jungle. And what had happened was that he had been, he was just walking through the jungle, and there were bandits around, or the rebels at that time, and they shot him in the back, and he never knew where the shot came from or anything like that. So he was just kind of walking one moment, and the next moment he was dead. And because he was so unprepared for it, his consciousness was just in this kind of state of shock and fear, and wasn't able to do anything. It was just still just hanging around in the area in this kind of state of shock and confusion, and didn't really realize that he was dead. And then this monk, the psychic power monk, sort of appeared to him and went and kind of manifested to him. And then he saw this monk, and it was like, because he had a lot of faith in Buddhism, it's the first time he realized, oh, there's a monk. And then he told him, you've died now, it's time for you to take rebirth. And he just paid respects to this monk, and then because he had the faith arose, then he went to heaven. Got reborn in heaven. So and he wrote a book about Satori. Yeah. 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 So that's a good story. So It seems, I mean, obviously when you're talking about those things, you're dealing with similar kinds of things, within a similar kind of realm of experience. But there does seem to be a wide range of things which are recognized as being Kensho or Satori within the Japanese tradition. And in some cases, I mean, you know, you have cases of people who are recognized as having Satori and things like that, who then go on to, you know, enthusiastically endorse violent war and these kinds of things, which does raise a question about their particular attainments, but I'm sure that there are similar things within other traditions as well. Yeah. I couldn't really say. Some people have, I think it was Douglas Burns, I think in his thing, he said the examples he looked at were more like conversion. He compared it to Christian conversion experiences rather than enlightenment experiences. But I'm not sure. Okay, so now the eight jhanas, and now to the ninth jhana, the mysterious Punisha Param Bhikkhave Bhikkhu. Sabbaso neva sanyana sanya yatanang samati kamma sanya vedayita nirodhang upasampadya viharati. Okay, so he enters and abides in the cessation of sanya, perception, and vedayita. Perception, vedayita, literally, they say perception and feeling, but it's actually this past participle form, so it would be perception and what is felt. Vedayita meaning, of course, vedana or feeling, but also being close in meaning to experience or awareness. And sanya and vedana are always taken to be two of the universal mental factors, and so the cessation of perception and feeling here is always taken, certainly within the Pali tradition, as being the cessation of all mental factors. So the mind, completely ends for that period. So it's a meditation attainment where the mind ends. And this is, of course, a very mysterious thing. It's described in Theravada. It's, in a sense, it's very difficult when you get to these kind of levels of attainment. It's very difficult to differentiate things and work out exactly what's going on. One thing that's happening here is that this is a temporary meditation attainment. Okay, it's not identical with Nibbana. Nibbana is not a meditation attainment. Nibbana also, of course, has the cessation of perception of feeling and other mental factors. But this is a temporary mental attainment. One who attains this is supposed to be protected against all kind of weapons and all of these kinds of things. In fact, anything from fourth jhana on up is. And it's described, one thing it's described in the Theravada tradition is different from Nibbana, is that Nibbana is that Sabhava Dhamma, so it's a really, truly, really existing thing, right? And Sanya Vedaita Nirodha is described as an Asabhava Dhamma. So it's a dhamma which doesn't have any essence, okay? Because it's mere cessation. Okay, now that's the Theravadan way of doing things. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it's the Theravadan way of looking at Abhidhamma. Yeah. Now then, notice this phrase here, and then it's having entered this one. Now all of the others, of course, you know, you go into the attainment. And then that's it. It's just, you know, you enter the attainment upasampajya viharati. And here, upasampajya viharati, it has this extra phrase at the end. Panyaya chasa viswa asava parikirna honti. Okay? Having seen with wisdom, having seen, okay, viswa, with wisdom, panyaya, asava, his defilements, parikirna honti, come to an end. So it has this little extra phrase at the end. This little extra phrase is not in the Chinese version. Okay. Now, obviously, the ending of defilements indicates arahantship. Typically, what the Theravadan tradition says is that this attainment, when you emerge from this attainment, if you can get there, then you will automatically become at least an anagami or an arahant. Okay. This is what they say. This is what Ajahn Brahm quotes as being this is the example of pure samatha. So he says that vipassana people say you just have to do vipassana, you don't have to do samatha. And he says this is just pure samatha path, you don't have to do vipassana.
Yeah, right.
So he says that just to stir people up generally. In one sense, in a practical sense, it's not such an issue, because somebody who's developing the path properly, obviously, they're not just going to sit down there the first time they meditate and go through all these things. It's going to be a long process of development, and in that process of development, there'll be periods when they're also developing insight and so on. So that's a normal way of doing things. According to the Theravadan tradition, again, this attainment, nirvasanya nasanya ayatanang, is dependent on a full development and maturation of the powers of both samatha and vipassana. Yeah. And I think, if I remember rightly, you have to have mastered the eight jhanas and also have mastered sankhara upekkha jnana. I think, and that's according to Visuddhimagga, something like that, to get into that attainment. So those things are already fully, really ripe. And then when you come out of the attainment, and then to get in there, and when you come out of the attainment, then it's just that seeing, oh, okay, that's what that is. And then they can go. Yeah.
So this ninth attainment.
Yeah. No, not necessarily. You certainly don't have to get it, but it's one way of doing it, yeah? Because many people become enlightened just after doing, you know, four jhanas or whatever. That's not controversial. So there's nowhere where it says you have to go through all of these processes. It's just an example here. Obviously, the highest level of samadhi that you can develop. I mean, there are some people who claim, like Ajahn Mahabua claims to have reached this attainment, and talks about it in his talks. But whether that's the same attainment, I mean, it's very, as you can see, the text doesn't give you a whole lot in terms of a description of what's happening. So it's difficult to work out exactly what. Is it that they're only available to them, or that they, when they emerge from it, that they become anagamis? Yeah.
If you do attain
it, yeah, then you become a
yeah,
you.
Then you become a and come back to the reflection that obviously there's a reflection there, because when you come out there, then you realize, oh, well, the mind is there, but that in itself is kind of a thing.
Yeah. Panyaya, this way, yeah.
So it's not to say that there was no instrument, but there was.
Yeah. Mm. Sorry, I just have to correct myself. I just made a mistake earlier. I said that the Chinese didn't have this phrase, Panyaya Chasadiswa Asava Parikirna Honti. That's not correct. The passage that the Chinese is missing is this passage at the end, Tirno Loke Visaptikanti. Okay, which, having crossed over the world and is free of attachments. So this, this particular phrase is, only found in the Pali version. Of course, that's indicating an arahat. It also describes it that way. Yeah. So remember that the context of these things is being taught as like a safe dwelling place that you can go to. Yeah. So you go in there, you hide from Mara in your safe dwelling place where Mara can't go, and then you know you come out and you know you have your meal or whatever, but then you've got your place that you can go to. So they're temporary refuges. Yeah? Okay. This is the simile of the bait. Now, I'm just wondering whether we want to hear from the letters, Mara's letters, to if we want to hear the more in some more detail about how Mara manages to get his baits. Is anybody interested? This is a thing from Ajahn Puna Dhammo, and it's got his sorry, I can't show you this particular passage, but on his website here, it's index for Mara's letters, and has a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And then it says, yeah, it says, underneath it says, mouse over here, baby, to see the real me. And so you move your mouse over and it, oh, you can come and have a look at the
does it not
okay. I'm not sure how to project this onto the screen. Anyway. There's Marilyn. This is mouse over. This is my mouse. Okay, here we go. Ah, the real Marilyn becomes a skull. So this is Ajahn Puna Dhamma's sense of humour. And the caption there says, mouse over here, baby, to see the real me. And then when it goes to the skull, it says, mouse over again to return to your illusions, sucker. Yeah, you have to drag this over there. Oh, there we go. Ah, easy. Ah, okay, here we go. Mouse over here, baby, to see the real me. There you go. Just return to your illusion. Okay. So this is the first army. I can't go through the whole thing, but this is something that was written by Tan Venerable Puna Dhamma, who's a friend of mine from the old Thai days. You well deserve to this is a letter to the first army, the host of sense desires. You well deserve the honor of being my beloved first host. In most cases, your work alone is enough to keep beings in line. Your five divisions assault our victims with all the enchantments of sensory pleasure. Beings spend their lives coming to you. Your sacrificial visitors come to the altar willingly, even eagerly. But this is no reason to slacken in your efforts. There is always the danger that they will begin to see. Let us be perfectly frank among ourselves, the shoddy nature of the goods. We know that sense pleasures are entirely unsatisfactory and illusory. In spite of all our inventiveness, we have never come up with any pleasure that is completely satisfying, lasting or substantial. Fortunately, the vast majority of humans don't realize this. The foolish little beggars all seem to imagine that the only pleasures that they've had so far are like this. Somehow they will find the magic trinket that will let them live happily ever after. I know this sounds preposterous, but most humans don't think these things through very carefully. They like what feels good and never mind the consequences. The only trick for them is to keep them diverted and entertained. We must keep coming up with new enticements as the old ones become tired. Although he have few tried and true standards, sex and food primarily, even here we need to keep coming up with new variations and twists. So far you've been doing the job marvelously. Take sex, for example. This has been our weapon of choice for about 1 billion years now. For a simple biological function, it does allow for a great deal of creative possibilities. What a wonderful swindle it all is. All the weird and wonderful variations they get themselves so frenzied about, all reduced to some tricky wiring and a simple bit of friction. In one sense, it isn't sex itself that keeps us in business, but all the peripheral things that go with it. All of the expectations and preliminaries, all the accessories and emotional baggage. Fortunately, there's enough of this stuff to keep most of them going for a lifetime. And one lifetime at a time is all we need to concern ourselves with. They'll keep coming back for more of the same. So it goes on in that vein. So.
I think the Montgomery in Myanmar, this is a rip-off of the screwdriver.
Screw tape letters.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis. And don't, at the end here, and don't forget to whisper all the current buzz that keeps them from doing body meditations. You know what I mean. Meditation on the unlovely is life-denying, uptight, repressive. It's easy enough to convince them because it's what they want to hear. Keep them imagining that they can have their cake and eat it too, and then we can stop worrying. Let them meditate all they want. As long as they think they don't have to let anything go, we're still in control.
Is it chocolate
cake? Yeah. Ajahn Pune, he's got a good thing. All right. So, any rapas with that?
Bhagavato Sangha Sangha.